That's good. That computer works. This is where I would sometimes play another song. Start the show with the regular theme song, and where I would play another song. You know, like a something thematic, something I wanted to talk about. That ain't gonna happen.
You can't do that.
I'm a one computer man today, Swanee. It's like back in the old days.
Well, how about when we had no computers? You mentioned the tape cartridge machines.
I like to call them 8-tracks, even though they weren't.
Well, they look like 8-tracks.
They look just like 8-tracks.
Yeah. For those young broadcasters out there who've never seen one.
Tape? What's tape?
One. Oh, yeah. I've had young'uns walk up to me and go, did you work with analog tape?
Oh, really? They even know what analog tape is?
Yeah, right. Well, of course, we never referred to it as analog back in the day to distinguish it from digital. But, so he was like, you worked with analog tape? As if it was cumbersome and laborious.
It was.
And a burden.
It was all those things. It was all those things. But you know what? In all my years, I never broke a tape machine.
I did.
Did you?
Yeah.
What'd you do to it?
I don't know. I hit a button a little too hard and it jammed and it wouldn't stop playing.
Oh, wow. Oh, I'm sure there are going to be some meetings about this computer that I broke now.
I've already seen emails cropping up here.
I'm not surprised. I can't tell because I can't see my emails.
Oh, that's it. Can you jump to another screen over there?
No, it's too much trouble.
All right. Well, like I said, I saw you preoccupied down there, and this is what you were preoccupied with.
Can you see the engineer Bob Ferguson's, trying to help and resolve this issue? But can you see on the closed circuit monitor, and I guess if you're on WGN radio, if you haven't broken your own computers at all, you can see the studio here, but can you see like the remnants of the? All I did was move it, and something happened with the cord.
Oh, there, okay, off to the right.
But it looks like shrapnel hit.
Yeah.
it looks like some bombs went off
in
here.
It looks like the building outside when they were filming Transformers.
Yeah,
when there was all kinds of debris, to say the least, in front of Tribune Tower.
I did recognize that piece from Saving Private Ryan, actually. It's exactly where that's from.
It looks very sad. And oh, well. Enough about my troubles.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year
to you.
We're
on till one.
And we need to wish Sam a Merry Christmas.
That's right, because today is the Eastern Orthodox Christmas.
How do you say it again, Sam?
Christos Serodi.
Thank you.
And then when you say it back, you say Vaistinus Rodi.
Go ahead, John.
Which means a Merry Christmas to you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, Dean, the Greeks actually...
The literal translation, Ashwani, and that is right back at you.
Right back at you. Okay.
Or si, senor.
Yeah.
Now, the Greeks actually are back on the 25th, right? The Greeks don't celebrate?
No, I think the technical is actually today.
Oh.
I think it's just, we've gotten away from it in our family. We just do the 25th now because... But if my grandmother was still alive, we would be celebrating today. If you stay to the old rules or, you've adapted and changed through the years. I like Christmas being today because I was in the grocery store yesterday. Swanee, as you know, I love going to the grocery store.
Yeah, but you don't want to talk about what's in your grocery.
Because it's none of your business what's in my grocery.
And you walk around the store with a blanket.
It's a tarp. It's a tarp. Yeah. It's a lead-based tarp because I don't want anyone with x-ray glasses looking.
with a biohazard sign on the top of it?
Well, sometimes
just to make sure people stay away?
But the Christmas candy was 75% off yesterday. That's a fantastic deal.
Christmas and the Easter.
Who wouldn't want to celebrate Christmas after the 25th if you get everything 75% off?
And the past purchase dates that are stamped on there are 2 weeks ago, right?
Well, it's still edible.
Yeah, it is.
Sort of.
Computer screens are 80% off today.
Yeah, they're 0% off in here right now.
It's your local
right
Serbian Best Buy. You get a monitor 80% off.
Well, and you know what I've done now? Because we have the broken monitor and I have the good one. I've mixed up which is the bad keyboard and mouse and which is the good one.
The naughty ones.
You don't know which is which.
Well, I'll find out in a second, but at the moment I don't know.
What a way to start.
Yeah, so anyway, to all those celebrating today, Merry Christmas. And as we say in my country, take your decorations down.
I will be doing that today and tomorrow.
Do you have a lot of decorations up at home? I don't picture you as a decorator at home.
I don't really, but every card that I get, I kind of display. Makes the room look a little seasonal, you know.
A card,
one or two. I got three this year.
You got three Christmas cards this year.
And I put them up and around.
Did you get mine?
No, because I don't. Did you send me one?
No, I didn't.
That's why I didn't get it.
I stopped sending Christmas cards. I like a nice Christmas email.
Yeah. Right. Just type in Merry Christmas and then put a little icon.
Copy, paste. Is there anything more really heartfelt holiday greeting than one that is copied and pasted and sent to your entire mailing list?
Well, how about one that's bulk emailed that says Merry Christmas to you all? And there's about 50 addresses on the end of the
that's
send
heartfelt.
Column.
That brings a tear to my eye.
Isn't that just warm and fuzzy?
Yep. Sure is. Well, we should probably get on with the show.
You going to keep us updated on the computer situation down there?
Well, I'm just trying to figure out which keyboard I'm supposed to use.
No. You can talk to me. Talk to me.
Learn how real Chicagoans live the day-to-day struggles and successes with health, fitness, and food. Watch Living Healthy Sundays on WGN-TV. The NFL playoffs getting underway, and Andy Mazur, WGN Sports, on the line with us here. And big night for Atlanta last night, right?
Yeah, how about that? The Falcons go into the Coliseum in Los Angeles and beat the Rams, who are favored in that game, 26-13. And kind of look like Atlanta had a little bit of a mission in mind after they blew that lead in the Super Bowl last year. They look like they want to get back there and certainly played a pretty good game. The thing that was amazing to watch about that game was that everybody was flipping on the turf out there. It was 60-some degrees, but the turf looked like it was in pretty bad shape. And thankfully, nobody got injured in that game. But Atlanta was going to move on, and now the Rams will kind of lick their wounds a little bit and get ready for next year. They lost 26-13.
And the game that was earlier in the day, the Titans and Kansas City?
Titans and the Chiefs, yeah.
Yeah, super, super, super close game.
Yeah, it was. It's incredible to think that the last time that the Kansas City Chiefs won a playoff game at home was 1994. Their quarterback at that time was a guy named Joe Montana.
Wow.
And, that's the last time they won a playoff game at home, and they certainly look like they were in control. They had Tennessee down big by 18 points at halftime, and Tennessee came right back out, and Marcus Mariota had a tremendous second half. The quarterback for the Titans, he actually threw a pass that was deflected, went right back to him, and he scored a touchdown. So he threw a touchdown pass and a reception on the same play, and the Titans went on to win 22-21. So those in Kansas City are a little bit up in arms today, and really can't blame them. They were favored in that game as well. And it's hard to imagine how that team can't win at home. They have a tremendous home field advantage at Arrowhead Stadium there in Kansas City. It's a great venue. It's one of the bigger venues in the NFL, and they all come out and support them. And all of a sudden, they just kind of lost their way there in that second half.
Yeah, well, you know, we've seen that happen so many times, right? I mean, plenty of Chicago teams where things just fall apart at the last minute like that. So today, we've got the Buffalo Bills and the Jacksonville Jaguars. And
the AFC.
Panthers and the Saints, is that right?
That's correct. Both of those are taking place today. And Buffalo is the darling, I think, of the AFC playoffs. They haven't been in the postseason since 1999. So that kind of has people rooting for them a little bit. And Jacksonville also some new blood in the AFC playoffs. But I think a lot of folks feel that all these teams are playing for third place because everybody kind of thinks that the Steelers and the Patriots will be the two meeting for the AFC Championship. But again, stranger things have happened.
Let me see here. We've got a Bulls defeat last night. Anything extraordinary, anything out of the ordinary happen in this 125-86 loss to the Pacers?
No, the tanking is back on track. I guess that's what people are thinking.
The tanking, thank goodness. All has returned right in the world. The Bulls are losing again.
Everything is right in the plan, and people are happy that they're losing, which is kind of seems strange to think. But, I think they were entertained by what they saw during that little stretch where Nico Maritich was leading them to 10 wins in 12 games. And people were getting a little bit up in arms saying, wait a minute, well, you guys are supposed to be losing. What's going on here? And, they did you a favor yesterday. They returned to losing ways, and they'll play at home tomorrow against the Houston Rockets.
And we're looking forward to the Blackhawks playing today on WGN. They'll take on the Oilers at 2:30, 1:30 pregame with Chris Bowden here on WGN. A little preview of what we might see today?
Yeah, you know, the Blackhawks, it's interesting. I mean, they lost the other day to the expansion of Las Vegas Golden Knights, and everybody's looking at the Las Vegas Golden Knights and saying, how's this team doing what it's doing? I mean, it's kind of a band of misfits together that they're trying to sell these guys an expansion, but you know, nobody wanted you. You guys are the cast-offs of the NHL, and they put together a tremendous season. I think the Hawks really have been playing much better hockey, at least in their last two or three games. I know the game the other night was not a win, but the way they battled and the way they were able to actually get some pucks into the net was pretty good. They're playing the Oilers for the second time in a week or so. And, the Oilers are a young team as well. They have this Connor McDavid kid who's pretty good. I mean, this kid's going to be the face of the NHL before too long if he's not already. But the Hawks play much better. I think Vinny Hinostroza and Jeff Glass have kind of given them a little bit of a boost in the last couple of games. So we'll see what happens here today. When you mentioned 1:30 pregame with Chris and a 2 o'clock puck drop at the United Center.
Good deal. And any highlights in college ball yesterday?
As far as college basketball was concerned, there was a bunch of local teams that were in action yesterday. Look at the DePaul Blue Demons. They win a Big East game. They beat St. John's 91-74 yesterday. Also, in local action, it was Evansville over Bradley, 68-44. Valpo got a win over Southern Illinois, 83-72 yesterday. And I guess we'll just continue the Missouri Valley board there. Drake over Indiana State, 75-72.
Very good, very good. And where are we and our head football coach for the Chicago Bears?
All right, well, that's an interesting question because
I purposely left that for last because I don't want to depress anybody talking about the Bears in the middle of everything else.
Well, they've interviewed several candidates, including defensive coordinator Vic Fangio, and apparently that talk went pretty well. Even if he's not the choice of the Bears, it seems like he kind of understands what's going on there and where the organization values him. And he would be definitely a candidate for a defensive coordinator position there with the Bears still. But he's going to be able to talk to other teams here pretty soon as well. So Vic Fangio was interviewed, Pat Shermer and George Edwards, both with the Minnesota Vikings. They were both interviewed. The one's the defensive coordinator, the other the offensive coordinator. And I think the hot candidate is Josh McDaniels, who's the New England Patriots offensive coordinator. They met with him Friday as well. So those are the guys that have been interviewed. They still want to talk to Eagles quarterbacks coach John DeFilippo, and they want to talk now to Matt Nagy, who's the Kansas City Chiefs offensive coordinator. They've just been eliminated. And one other candidate that they'll talk to, among others, I'm sure, is Panthers defensive coordinator Steve Wilkes. So the process is underway. You have to worry now about guys that you want that are on teams that are still in the playoffs and still have a chance, because a lot of those teams won't let you interview these guys if they're not on a bye week. But the Patriots were on a bye week, so that was allowable. But once they get going again, you better try to identify those people quickly and move fast on those, because you don't want to get caught in a situation where you're playing the waiting game and then all of a sudden somebody else swoops in and gets your guys. So that's kind of where it's at right now.
Is the allure of becoming a head coach in the NFL greater to, in a lot of these candidates that you're talking about, than coming into an organization that is very clearly as damaged as the Bears are?
Well, yeah, you'd like to be the guy to repair it. I think there's a lot of people that feel that there's a job at hand, obviously, but I think the big selling point has been Mitchell Trubisky, the guy that they drafted number two overall last year and had, you know, his rookie year this year. He looked okay. But I think what they need to do is they need to figure out about putting people around him and finding a coach that can develop him. If it's not the head coach, at least an offensive coordinator or a quarterback's coach that can help. And I think there are a lot of candidates out there that would like to be a part of the media market that we have here in Chicago and a charter NFL franchise. And plus, when you become a head coach, your pension changes quite a bit. So I think if you're offered a head coaching job, I think you take it. And I think that there are still some decent things in place here. I mean, again, by all means, nothing is guaranteed, and especially with this team, the way that the offense looked this year. But you know, there's some promise on defense. And, you know, you have to hope that that Ryan Pace identified the right guy as quarterback, and quarterback is what you need in this league.
Yeah, obviously they're going to take their time on trying to choose the right person, but when do you expect that we might hear something? It's obviously going to be after the Super Bowl, right?
Well, you know, I think that they'll try to figure out if they can talk to a guy and get a verbal agreement before the Super Bowl. I think they would be happy with that. Kyle Shanahan was the choice of the San Francisco 49ers last year. He was the offensive coordinator for the Falcons, and it was leaked out that he was going to take the job during Super Bowl week. So you want to try to move quickly because, again, you want to identify your guy and make sure that you get your guy. So I think that's kind of the process right now.
Andy, have a great Sunday today, and we'll talk with you soon.
You got it. Take care.
There's Andy Mazur, WGN Sports.
The street, and he says, "Hey," he says, "can you give me 15 cents for a sandwich?" And the guy says, "I don't know, let me see a sandwich."
Great Gary Van Dyke, brother of Dick Van Dyke. Remember, he would appear as Rob Petrie's brother Stacy on several episodes of the old Dick Van Dyke show.
Was that the one where he was sleepwalking?
Yes,
and putting on an act in the living room?
Yeah, when he was sleeping, he was a fantastic performer. But when he wasn't, he was shy and awkward and, you know,
bumbling
and stumbling and all that. And really funny on the Dick Van Dyke show, but you know, appearing on many, many, many other shows, and I guess probably best known as Luther. Remember the character Luther on Coach?
On Coach. Yeah.
That ran for, it was like 5-6 years that it ran on network TV.
Yep.
And still runs, as a matter of fact, on our sister nostalgia channel, Antenna TV, weeknights at 10 o'clock. Jerry Van Dyke passed away over the weekend, so we're very sorry to report that. He had been in a pretty bad car accident with his wife a couple of years ago. And his wife, in making the announcement of his death, said he really never recuperated from that. His health pretty much deteriorated after that. Of course, born in Danville, Illinois, as we know. So, you know, kind of from the area. We know that, remember his television show, My Mother, the Car?
Yeah.
That ran, I think, maybe a half a season,
or maybe a full season.
It's generally regarded as one of the worst television sitcoms of all time.
It sounds awful on the surface.
Yeah, well, he gets this old, I don't even know, was it a Model T, Schwani?
Something like that.
Like one of
Model
those,
A, Model T.
One of those old cars, and it turns out that the car is his mother reincarnated.
Isn't that a wonderful premise for a show?
His mother talks to him through the radio of the car, which I don't think Model T's or Model A's had radios. But,
no, they didn't.
But anyway, the mother talked through that. He starred in another show called Accidentally Family, which I don't even remember.
I don't know that.
I have zero recollection of that, but he was on a lot of Love Boats. He was on, you know, the Fantasy Island. He was on all the variety shows.
Did you also know he was on Andy Griffith?
He was on Andy Griffith.
Yeah.
Made an appearance or two.
Yep.
Did you know that he was the first choice to play Gilligan on Gilligan's Island?
I just found that out.
He turned it down in order to star in My Mother, the Car.
Oh, my gosh.
Which I'm not sure, really, you know, which... was, you know, do you go down in history as starring in one of the worst sitcoms of all time, or do you go down in history as Gilligan, you know, which really Bob Denver was never able to.
He was successful for a few seasons.
Well, but it was successful, but, you know, he had to live with Gene Gilligan the rest of his life.
Right.
So
right.
I'm not sure if that was, you know, the worst thing in the world that could happen to him. He also, you know, the Bob Newhart series in which Bob Newhart ran the inn.
It was just called Newhart.
It was called Newhart, and in Vermont, and the role that Tom Poston had on that show, the George Utley character, the handyman on the show.
Hilarious.
That was supposed to have been
Jerry Van Dyke?
That was first offered to Jerry Van Dyke, and he turned that down also. But really talented guy. Never met him, never had an opportunity to meet him. But seemed like a super nice guy. I remember when he would go on Johnny Carson or David Letterman. There are some clips of him on Letterman that are hilarious. Letterman was so amused by him. Worth taking a look and remembering.
What was the difference in age between Jerry and Dick Van Dyke?
I believe 6 years.
Oh, that much? Okay.
I believe 6 years. And Dick Van Dyke was older
yeah.
by 6 years.
Okay.
And, you know, Dick Van Dyke, still seemingly in perfect health, amazing health, still spry, still energetic.
Well, you did the interview with him a year and a half ago,
yeah,
I guess.
We talked with him then, but, you know, we interviewed Lin-Manuel Miranda, Hamilton fame, not long ago, and he talked about working with Dick Van Dyke in this Mary Poppins, you know, sequel, I guess you might call it, remake, that they're finishing up right now. And he talked about how energetic and how with it Dick Van Dyke is. You know, at his age. So, anyway, so sorry to report the passing of Jerry Van Dyke. Certainly enjoyed his really some great entertainment through the years. And all of this following the death of Rosemarie of the Dick Van Dyke Show a week ago. You know, very, very, very sad. So, you know, we lost another member of that Dick Van Dyke Show family now. There is a pretty great documentary about the life of Rosemarie that's going to be opening in Chicago next, is next Friday the 12th? Is it the 12th? I think it is. January 12th is when this documentary called, Wait for the Laugh. And it's the story of Rosemarie's amazingly long career. She was one of the most popular performers in America at age 5. Little baby Rosemarie. And parlayed that into a lifetime full of showbiz success. We're going to talk with the director of that film a little bit later on this morning. That's all coming up here. Dean Richards, Sunday morning, WGN.
About what? About being a comedian. Well, Stace, I'd be happy to give you my opinion. When you want to show us what you do?
Yeah, right now?
Well, yeah. Yeah, have you got your banjo with you?
Yeah, it's in my barracks bag there.
Well, good. Go get it.
Huh?
Sure, go ahead.
Well, okay. Yeah, it isn't much, though, I'll tell you.
Well, go on and get it.
All right. I get a little tune in the barracks bag, but I can call it that. You want to hear me play?
Of course we are.
Sure we do.
I don't know. I'll tell you, I'm a little nervous.
Hey, be nervous. We're your relatives.
Yeah, but you're civilians. I never played for anybody but soldiers before.
Well, why don't you think of me as a former soldier?
Okay, I'll try.
Opening for the act.
No, I haven't started yet, Rob.
Jerry Van Dyke on the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Go
on YouTube, take a look at some of the old episodes. Stacy, his character, was awake. He was bumbling, stumbling, like he is right now, but when he was sleepwalking.
This is where I tell the joke.
He was rather brilliant.
Go ahead and tell the joke then.
This is a story about something.
Pretty funny stuff. Jerry Van Dyke passed away this weekend at 86 years old. A couple of other notes in showbiz this morning. Sarah Bareilles, who is a pretty notable pop singer, also has just completed starring on Broadway in Waitress, just announced is going to be joining the cast of Jesus Christ Superstar live in concert. This is the live musical that will be on NBC this coming Easter Sunday on April the 1st. She now will join John Legend, who will play Jesus in the production, and Alice Cooper, who will be King Herod in the production. So we'll hear Sarah Bareilles sing one of the signature songs from the show, I Don't Know How to Love Him. I'm sure it's going to be fantastic, but that's another great add to the casting of that show. Yesterday, the National Society of Film Critics gave out their awards for Best Pictures of the Year, and Lady Bird took honors as the very best picture of the year from the National Society of Film Critics. It's not the one that I picked for Best Movie of the Year. I picked Dunkirk, but a lot of people are loving Lady Bird, and you know, it's got a pretty good chance of winning some pretty big awards this year. In addition to Lady Bird winning, also one of Chicago's very own, Laurie Metcalf, who stars as Lady Bird's mother in the movie, Saoirse Ronan's mother in the movie, she took Best Supporting Actress. And that's one that pretty much everyone is agreeing could very definitely happen, not only for the Golden Globes tonight, but for the Academy Awards when those happen just after the first of the year. Sally Hawkins was the winner of Best Actress, according to the National Society of Film Critics. She stars in The Shape of Water. I met Sally Hawkins a couple of days ago in Los Angeles. She is one of the voices in this new Paddington 2 movie, the Paddington Bear movie, which is so well done and so charming, by the way. But Sally Hawkins does a character in the film. And she, in real life, in the interview, couldn't be more delightful. We'll share that interview with you next week. She won Best Actress. Daniel Kaluuya, who starred in the movie Get Out, won Best Actor. William Dafoe won for Best Supporting Actor in The Florida Project, which leads us to the Golden Globes, which are tonight, and the top categories. You know, they give out awards not only for movies but also for television, but they break it out music or comedy and drama. So the nominees for Best Movie, Musical or Comedy are Lady Bird, which isn't really musical or comedy. I, Tonya, also not really musical or comedy. The Greatest Showman, which is a musical, the Hugh Jackman movie. The Disaster Artist, I guess you could call a comedy. And Get Out, which is neither musical or comedy. For Best Drama, the nominees are Call Me By Your Name, Dunkirk, The Post, The Shape of Water, and Three Billboards from Ebbing, Missouri. If I was going to make a prediction, I would say I think that for Best Musical or Comedy, Lady Bird will be the winner. And for Best Movie in the Dramatic category, it's going to be Dunkirk or The Post. It's the Hollywood Foreign Press, so it might be The Shape of Water. It's very possible the Shape of Water could win. That's going to be a tough category to pick. For Best Television, Musical or Comedy, the nominees are Blackish, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Master of None, Smilf, and Will and Grace. For Best TV Series Drama, The Crown, Game of Thrones, The Handmaid's Tale, Stranger Things, and This Is Up. I'm hoping for Will and Grace to win because I think their return onto television has been pretty great. I think on the dramatic side, I don't really watch these shows. Don't watch a whole bunch of TV drama, but just based on, you know, all the buzz and what everybody says, it's probably going to be Game of Thrones there. So that's on at 7 o'clock tonight, and Seth Meyers will be the host of that. Oh, brother.
despite a few technical snafus this morning, we're back on track. And you know what? I think people seem to love when things go wrong.
Is that what you're hearing?
I've gotten some texts and Facebook messages, and people think it's hilarious when when I'm going through some sort of technical anguish. People think it's hilarious. So I'm glad I could amuse you. What am I, like a clown to you people?
It is quite stressful when we have equipment malfunctions.
Yeah, fine. Hey, you know, we were talking about Jerry Van Dyke sadly passing away over the weekend. And we were talking about his TV show that he had, My Mother the Car.
My Mother the Car, yeah.
It was on a full season.
Was it on for a full season?
I thought it was on less than that, but it's generally regarded as one of the worst TV sitcoms of all time. and I haven't seen it in 100 years, so I don't really remember, but some people have been sending me the lyrics to the theme song, and I did look that up. Give this a little bit.
Everybody knows in the second life we all come back sooner or later. And anything from a busted cat to a man-eating alligator. Well, you only think my story is more fiction than it's fact. But believe it or not, my mother decided she'd come back as a call. She's a very woman.
It's hard to believe that that show didn't catch on. It's hard to believe that that was not the Seinfeld of its day. With clever lyrics like that in the opening theme song.
What kind of plot line would you have for a show like that?
Well, I vaguely remember watching the show when I was a kid. And it was, let me see, what were the exact years? 65. It premiered September 1965 and was off April 66. Total of 30 episodes were produced. And I vaguely remember, you know, that wacky things would come up in, you know, the life of this family. And, you know, Jerry Van Dyke was, you know, couldn't figure out what to do and would seek advice and counsel from his mother, the car.
This was on NBC.
This was on NBC.
Yeah.
National Television Network put the show on.
My Mother, the Car.
So there you go. Just one of the... imagine what Gilligan's Island would have been like had Jerry Van Dyke, been Gilligan instead of Bob Denver. He turned the role down.
He might have done the characters in a similar way, you know, kind of that
fumbly, stumbly. We now think of Gilligan as so quintessentially Bob Denver.
Oh, absolutely.
It's hard to imagine anybody else in that role.
And would Jerry have been called Little Buddy?
Yeah, very true. Very, very true.
Would he have been Little Buddy in the show?
Very true. These are some of the questions
great
that we're pondering. That's right. We are deep thinkers on this Sunday show.
I'll tell you, this last hour and 15 minutes has just been
memorable. For all the wrong reasons. Let's move on to the weather, though. Meteorologist Mike Hamernick is standing by. He's got some good news for us, I think, in our weather department.
Yeah, we sure do, Dean. Wow. It's been a long time since we've been able to pass along anything that remotely warm or mild as far as temperatures are concerned, and we've finally broken this Arctic air masses back.
Are we at the warmest point that we've been in like a week, something right now?
More than that. 2 weeks.
At
9 a.m. this morning, we reached 20 degrees, and it's the first time we've been at 20 degrees since 1 a.m. on Christmas morning.
Wow.
So it's almost been 2 weeks we've been in this bitterly cold Arctic air here in Chicago. And I tell you, 20 degrees never felt so good. You step outside, and if you're out of the wind, it feels pretty good out there, kind of balmy. And the good news is it's going to stick around for a while. We've got 30s and even some 40s in the forecast this week, so we're finally going to break out of this Arctic spell. We'll pay a bit of a price today because we'll have to deal with some precipitation, kind of a transition day today from that Arctic air to a warm, moderate brand of cold. for tomorrow as well as Tuesday, and that means some precipitation and a little bit of a concern for some icy roads later today because we'll have a wintry mix of some freezing rain, some sleet, as well as some snow. And we've been so cold lately that even if the air temperatures get up around 32 later today, which they could may get close to, the ground is still so frozen that any liquid raindrops would freeze almost instantly on the pavement. So that could lead to some very icy conditions very quickly. So that's something we'll keep a close eye on. In fact, right now we're getting some reports of freezing rain as well as some ice pellets around Morris and Kankakee. That's the first wave of precipitation that's headed our way, and another one on the way later on this afternoon. So if you're headed out and about, you can keep a hand on the wheel, and if you see raindrops on the windshield, you might want to really slow it down because that liquid rain would freeze instantly on untreated roads.
That's when it's really the most dangerous, when we have that thin layer, super thin layer, that really you cannot see, that makes things, get so slippery. And the salt, on the ice isn't super effective when it's as cold as it's been.
Yeah, we're still well below the freezing mark, 22 at this hour. So it could get slick in a hurry. So be aware of that if you're going to be out and about, especially the ice pellets I'm not too worried about. The snowflakes, it's going to get a little slick, but it's that liquid rain. If you see that on the windshield, that's the one that can really get a little dangerous out there for an hour or two until the road crews get out and get some salt down. And there is some residual salt on the roadways, and that may help a little bit. But watch out for some patchy freezing rain, because I think we'll stay below the freezing mark throughout the day today. But tomorrow we're up above freezing, looking for high 37 both tomorrow and Tuesday. And the big January thaw's on the way, still on track for Wednesday and Thursday. We may be pushing 50 degrees around here on Thursday, which...
Did you say 50?
50, yeah. We'll be
5-0. You're saying 5-0.
Yes, yes.
What are you drinking this morning? So I'll have what he's having.
We're about to pop some champagne back here because we've finally broken this Arctic spell.
Yeah, I think a lot of people feel like celebrating because of that.
Mike, what was it that caused this for such a long period of time?
Well, it's basically a persistent pattern that wouldn't give up. We had several waves, as many as four or five of these waves of Arctic air that were pushed south into North America because there was a lot of warm air up around the North Pole. So you get that warm air in the North Pole, the cold air has to go somewhere. Sometimes it dumps down in Europe, sometimes it dumps down in Siberia. Sometimes it dumps down in North America, and this was our turn, and it really had nowhere to go for a couple of weeks, and it really a historic spell. We haven't had a 12 days in a row of sub-20 degree temperatures here in Chicago. We've only actually done it twice. We tied the record for that, one time back in 1936 and another time back in the 1800s. So as far as length it goes, as far as temperatures below 20 degrees, we basically tied a record for number of days below 20 degrees, so historic in that respect.
Yeah, I remember it being cold. I don't remember it being cold for as long as it's been cold.
Right, and I mean, the polar vortex was much colder, but it didn't last as long.
Right.
We were, up in the 30s and 40s
came
for
and
four
went,
or five
right,
days.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, right.
So, and I don't see another one of these. We're going to cool back down again after the warm-up on Thursday and Friday over the weekend, but that only looks like about a 4 or 5 day spell of colder weather, and then we'll be back up into the 30s and 40s for the third week in January. And interesting to note, too, things could turn a little bit stormy, too, in that third week of January, which could lead to some snow. We're way, way behind as far as snow is concerned, which is interesting in the fact that it's been so cold, we haven't had a lot of snow. 5.5 inches of snow for the year, which is only about 50% of normal. Last year, we had 17 inches of snow at this point. And get this, this is the kicker. Hilton Head, South Carolina, they've had almost as much snow as we've had here in Chicago this winter. 4.5 inches of snow so far this season in Hilton Head, which is almost like tropical down there in South Carolina. We've had 5.5 inches of snow. So we're right on par with Hilton Head as far as snow is concerned.
I had this conversation with somebody the other day. Would you rather have it be super cold, or would you rather have more snow? And I think I'd rather have it be super cold.
Yeah, it's in some ways it's easier to deal with. But
you don't have to shovel super cold.
Yeah, but you have to hibernate. It's a lot easier to. You can't stay out very long in super cold. I don't mind either, as long as it doesn't stick around for 2 weeks. It gets a little old.
Yeah, that was a little bit of a challenge, the length of time on this one. What about the East Coast? I mean, as much as we've been complaining, talk about you know, getting the snow. They sure did up and down the eastern seaboard.
Well, they sure did. Up to 20 inches of snow in portions of New England, and brutally cold this morning, and all the ocean water that made it inland during that storm with the high tide and the high waves, that froze instantly. So it's a lot of cars right now packed in ice along the shores of the Atlantic Ocean, unfortunately. And so this warmth that's here in Chicago eventually will get out to the East Coast, but yeah, they're still dealing with a brutally cold morning out in Boston. They set a record of -2 this morning.
Done with the snow, though.
Yeah, they're done with the snow. They may get some rain later this week, but like us, our next storm system beyond today is going to be Rainmaker on Wednesday and Thursday with that warm air. Don't expect sunshine in 50 degrees, but it's going to be cloudy, kind of foggy and misty with kind of almost a spring-like feel to it with the 40-degree temperatures on Thursday.
Wow. Okay. So we've got some things to look forward to, but still some precautions that we need to take over the next couple of days.
Yeah. The one travel problem today would be, the possibility of some freezing rain. So be on the lookout for that if you're going to be traveling.
All right. Mike Hammernick, our WGN Weather Center. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Talking about movies, I want to tell you about a couple of movies that I saw this week in Los Angeles. Got an early look at the new Paddington Bear movie. The Paddington movie, I guess, came out, what, like 4-5 years ago, something like that. Kids movie, basically, family film, I think is more accurately the best way to describe it. And I liked the first one. But this new one, Paddington 2, it's called, is absolutely charming. This movie should have come out before Christmas time. It is a quintessential family movie about this lovable bear that's taken in by a family in London. Circumstances happen where he is falsely accused of a crime and is put in jail, all orchestrated by the bad guy of the movie, who is played by Hugh Grant. Hugh Grant, who hasn't done a movie in a couple of years, chooses to do this family film and is spectacular in this movie as the villain. He's a very funny, he's a sort of a over the top, past his prime actor who is trying to get his hands on a fortune in jewels. That's part of this whole storyline. But Hugh Grant is so great. The story is so great. Sally Hawkins from Shape of Water is in the movie. Hugh Bonneville is in the movie. So delightful. If you've got kids, definitely take your kids to see this when it opens next Friday. But even if you don't have kids, you're going to walk out ear-to-ear grin with this movie. I promise you that. And next Sunday, we'll share the interviews that I did with Hugh Grant, with Hugh Bonneville, with Sally Hawkins. We had the nicest time seeing this movie and talking with the cast, so I'm highly recommending that. The other movie that I got an early look at is this movie that you've been seeing commercials for called 12 Strong. And this is a post 9/11 war movie. It's the story of a U.S. Special Forces team, the first U.S. Special Forces team to go into Afghanistan after September 11th to try to destroy ISIS, not ISIS, Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. This was even before ISIS. And Chris Hemsworth stars in the movie. Chicago's own Michael Pena stars in the movie. Rob Riggle is in the movie. Lots of young actors that you know. What makes this story really interesting is that because it's in the mountains of Afghanistan, it was actually shot in New Mexico. Just to, give you the real deal, they obviously didn't go to Afghanistan to shoot this movie. It was shot in the mountains of New Mexico, but in reality in the story, the Special Forces team of, young men, many of which had never been on horseback, had to go on horseback into these mountains. They were not, vehicle friendly, motorized vehicle friendly. So that's partially what makes this a really interesting story. It's these 12 U.S. soldiers who, for in many of their cases, had never been on horseback before, going into battle against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, vastly, vastly outnumbered, trying to, you know, seek revenge for 9/11. So this is another movie that we interviewed the whole cast, Chris Hemsworth, Michael Peña, Rob Riggle, who else we talked with? We talked with many of the cast members, and we'll share those with you in a couple of weeks. So I'm really curious, you know, how some of you are going to react to this, because it's also a difficult movie to watch. While it's really interesting and it's a true story and a great story of that patriotism that came post tragedy of 9/11, when people were joining the military like crazy. In this case, it was a group of you know, special teams operatives who were about to go home, and many of them came back in because they felt so strongly about what had happened to America in the attack. So it's this great story of patriotism, but it's tough to watch. You know, the war movies are difficult to watch and stir up a lot of you know, bad memories and bad emotions. So I'm really going to be curious to see how many of you react to that. That's going to open on the 19th, a week from this coming Friday. So we'll talk more about that later on. Now it is time for our first weekend theater segment for the new year. And there are you know, tons of shows that are going on. We've had a pretty good winter season on stage in Chicago for, you know, some of the big shows that are going on. But also, you know, and I've always said this, that the heart of Chicago's theater scene are some of the smaller shows that are going on that are often 20 times more powerful than the ones that you see on some of the downtown stages. And one example of that would be the world premiere of a show that's called Blue Over You, written by Daniel Noonan, directed by Sarah Whitney. What a coincidence that they would both be here in studio with us at the same time. What an odd turn of events that would be.
Well, we were walking by and we saw you, so we thought we'd just
Let's stop in. Right. Let's stop in and say hi to Uncle Dean. Isn't that nice? Very nice. Nice to see you both. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
First of all. So, Daniel, tell me about Blue Over You, because this is a story very close to your own personal life.
Yes. It's a little hard to talk about because it is a mystery. It's a mysterious one-man love story with musical bits. And basically, it's about a high school drama teacher who comes home from work one day and finds his wife missing. So it's his journey trying to find her and woo her back. But it's a comedy in parts, and it also addresses issues that affect millions of Americans. So I don't want to give too much away, but it is a mystery, and it is close to my heart, something that I thought about for years and wanted to write a story on.
Now, this is being presented at the Northminster Presbyterian Church
right
through January the 28th.
Correct.
And, you know, like I was saying, I think these are the kinds of productions that are so often so much more powerful to see in a smaller venue,
an intimate setting,
intimate setting than a gigantic, you know, arena, which is nice. I'm sure you'd like to be selling tickets to a gigantic arena, but would you? I don't know.
Not for this show, I wouldn't. It really needs the intimacy that you get with this space. There's 60 some odd seats, and Michael Joseph Mitchell, who is the one man starring in it, really is doing a tight wire act, basically, without a net. And it's really fun to watch this guy for 90 minutes, nonstop. There's two scene changes, which he's in, so he's there for the whole time. And it's just really great to watch him work up close I think for this piece, there's, you know, sure, there's other shows we would want to sell in a big Broadway.
You wouldn't want to do 42nd Street in North Mystery's Basement Church, but
it would be kind of cool, though, right?
Well, it would be kind of, although
you'd have to call it 8th Avenue or something. Right. It'd have to be a much smaller street than 42nd Street, I think. What's it like, Sarah, to direct a show and stage a show when it's just one performer?
Well, it's interesting you should ask, because I'm now based in St. Louis, and I have been working with a company there called Midnight Company, and the founder of it is a guy who is a master at doing one-man shows, and one critic called him the drug-sniffing dog of one-man shows, the great one-man shows. We just did Title Indeed by Will Eno this past summer. And so I've worked many times with him on a one-man show, and it is different. It's helpful to get a further look at it rather than a standard four-week rehearsal time. We talked with Michael this summer even and said, here's the script, get a look at it. I was back and forth working with him. Longer term helps with getting it into a part of your brain that you can really live with it for a while. But Michael's he's like the hardest working guy in show business right now, because he's doing this. He's doing a cabaret act this January as well, while he's doing this.
At Davenport's.
And then he's also, I think, starting rehearsals for a show at Chicago Shakes this month as well. So it's kind of amazing how these actors can have these brains that can compartmentalize.
Somebody needs to, study his brain of how he puts different parts of, his creative world and processes all of it.
It's remarkable. I think he should donate his
brain to science. No, he's very meticulous about how he memorizes. He has to, in his living room, he says he sets his two dogs up on the couch, so they're his audience, and he goes through this whole one-man show. I mean, he walks it, he gets it into his body, because otherwise I think it would be really hard for him to memorize 90 minutes straight. And we would offer to run lines with him, but he would say, no, I really need to physicalize it as I'm rehearsing. So I thought that was really interesting to work with Michael and find that out about him.
Very interesting that he'd rather rehearse with dogs than humans.
It is. I don't know what that says about me, but yes, his
dogs are unconditional love for
right.
a dog.
That's right.
They're
right there for him.
They're right there. If you can get them to pay attention for that long, that would be great. The actors that I've talked to have told me that it's more difficult doing a one-person show than working with a big, giant cast, because you have time to think a little bit during more conventional type shows where you have other castmates and you're reacting to things, as opposed to you are everything in the show. You're every character. You're every bit of scenery. You're everything in these one-person productions.
That's true. He has no one to play off of except the audience. He does speak to them directly. It's a direct address. And his flock of guardian angels are his other playing partner. And that fascinates me, too, because if you are in the middle of this show and you need to take a breather, how do you do that? And sometimes we work those in so that he has a moment that he can just even take a drink, take a sip, and have that split second where he can stop for a moment. But yes, I have such admiration of actors, but specifically ones that are willing to tackle a one-man show. He did one 10 years ago. Jinx, you owe me a Coke.
Yes.
I have not heard that since I was 12 years old.
There you go.
Well, that's fantastic.
Dan and I are like best buddies. but so, and he was like, this is going to be a real challenge 10 years later to take this on. But he's also the one, this is a baby that has only been gestating for
nine years.
Wow. So, and Michael was the first actor that we thought of when we said, we just need somebody to read this to us. So he has been in touch with the script over the years as well. And I think it's in a part of him that is deeper than something he would have just seen recently.
Yeah, if we did make it clear before, the Michael that they're referring to is Michael Joseph Mitchell, who stars in the show Blue Over You. We'll talk more with its director and playwright in just a moment. It's playing, by the way, through January the 28th at Northminster Presbyterian Church in Evanston. In studio with us this morning is Sarah Whitney and Daniel Noonan. They are the director and playwright of the world premiere of the production of Blue Over You, which is in Chicago pretty much for the month of January. Daniel, talk to me a little bit about how you came up with all this. I know it's difficult to talk about because you don't want to give things away, but as best you can, just how you even come up with this. You mentioned that, you know, what a process this was. How many years?
I think I finished the first draft in 2008.
Wow.
That's
a process.
That's 9 years ago.
Yeah.
And it was, most things that I write are motivated by things that happen to me in my personal life or with my family. And I don't write the exact story, but it's the impetus for me to write a broader story. So I had something I wanted to write about, and I also knew I wanted it to be a love story. So Francis is completely despondent that his wife is missing, and he really wants to find her and bring her back. And I just thought this would be kind of an interesting twist with the mystery and the love story together. But it does come from somewhere in my personal life. But like I said, I'll talk about that once the show closes.
All right, let's make a date to come back.
Yeah, sounds good.
When people can no longer see the show.
Right.
To explain it all. Like, what are the kinds of things in the past that have been part of your own life that you've turned, you know, that it clicked a creative spark that turned into something else?
Sure. Well, Sarah and I worked on a show together called Out Among the Dragons that was also produced at Northminster in 2005. And that speaks to my experience. I have hemophilia, and as a result, I also have HIV. So I grew up with that. I became HIV positive when I was 13. And I went through the whole roller coaster experience of the AIDS epidemic in the United States in the 80s and 90s and still today. And so I wanted to write about three people who had contracted the virus in three different ways and what that means and how, unfortunately, there's a big stigma attached to some people depending on how they acquire the virus. And the hemophiliac who's always thought of as the innocent victim. So that was a very personal story, which I turned into a comedy, believe it or not. And it was three people who met in an infectious disease clinic and became friends and really started to work with each other to help them realize their goals and dreams. And this was before The Cocktail came out in 1994.
I was going to ask you what year that was, because there was a time when there was nothing funny about talking about HIV whatsoever.
Right.
You know, but the fact that you wrote it makes it different, and the fact that the whole way, you know, that we battle HIV now and its consequences, 100% different now.
Yes.
Makes a big difference, in all of that.
Right, right. And I chose, it was produced in 2005, but the play is set in 1994 because that's when The Cocktail first came out. It was right when things changed. But what I wanted to, one of the issues I wanted to address in the play is that although there were life-saving drugs, the stigma was still there, and people couldn't escape that. And, yeah, I think the stigma is one of the biggest problems with the whole AIDS epidemic. People afraid to go get tested because they don't want to have to explain to anybody it's
right
why they have it.
Right, right, right. Was that difficult for you in dealing with that personally?
The stigma?
Yeah.
Well, a little bit at first, yes. I mean, I had roommates in college who were nervous to be living with me because I was HIV positive. This was in the late 80s, and people weren't as informed as you would like them to be. So there was that. But overall, I would say I was kind of a poster child, an innocent victim. This is why we should care.
Because you're hemophiliac.
Right, yeah. Right. Which is very sad in my opinion, but in many ways I was viewed as someone who was innocent. And so, you know, We were all in it together, though, and thank God they finally came up with a cocktail.
Yeah, yeah, and good that it opened up a conversation about it.
Yes.
Especially back then, opened up a conversation about it, and that you were able to write something that wasn't dire and tragic and, you know, that was lighthearted about the whole thing that made it easier for people to talk about the subject. I remember talking about AIDS and HIV on the radio,
sure,
back then, and how controversial it was to even bring it up,
right?
Back then, people freaked out at the idea of even bringing something up over the public airwaves that might save their lives.
Right, right.
The best part about Dan and his writing is that he takes subjects that could be really heavy and heady and maybe difficult to deal with, and he starts out by cracking you open with the comedy, and so that once you're comfortable enough with these characters and can laugh at the situations, then he's able to bring in the point that he needs to make. And a lot of times it has to do with compassion, and that's something I love about working with Dan. He opens me up to being more compassionate, but I just love how his style is crack them open with some comedy, and then you've got them so you can talk.
Is that an intentional technique where you're, I'll do this to crack them open with the comedy and then make my point, or
no,
does it
I wouldn't
just sort
say
of evolve?
It's just part of my writing, yeah. I think, and being a person living with multiple chronic health conditions, I was very fortunate. My mother was loving and funny and kind, and she always taught me to find the humor in the situation, and that really translated into my writing. So it's hard for me to not see often the absurdity and humor in a lot of situations. And that was true growing up with HIV. I mean, it was not easy, but there were things that were kind of absurd and funny about it, and that eventually made its way into my writing.
Not something that you hear people say who grew, especially from age 13.
Right.
At the time when HIV was so serious, to be able to find absurdity,
well, I tell this
and
one,
humor in the whole thing is rather remarkable.
I mean, I was probably 19 or 20, and I was having a doctor's visit, and there was a resident who came in, and we were just talking about where my T-cells were and how I was doing, and he drew a little bar chart. And he drew my line off the chart. He's like, well, people lose maybe 50 to 100 T-cells a year, and you're here, so in 4 years, you could be in real trouble. He didn't say that, but he just drew my line off the chart. And I said, how can you do that to a patient? Yeah. Draw their line off the chart. I said, this is crazy.
Yeah, nobody wants to see that.
No, no. Yeah. Unfortunately, that didn't happen to me, but he was trying his best. He thought he was enlightening me to my situation, yeah. But
Dan is a walking miracle, and one of the reasons why we decided to risk doing this show is because he's taught me, you know, life is too short. You know, if you've got a good play and you want people to see it, put it on. He's sort of informed me of his story throughout his life, and I'm always impressed with how he always looks on the sunny side and finds the jokes, and also says, now is the time, because we're not guaranteed. Yeah.
What a great lesson, to be learned, not just in this production, but for life in general, that people are so cautious about things in fear of what might happen if it fails. But even sadder, what would happen if you never even try?
Yes.
And then fail, you know, because you also may succeed at the same time. Good for you. This is an inspiring story today. This is a very inspiring theater segment today.
Oh, I'm glad it is.
Perfect for the first segment of the new year today to start off on a note like this. The world premiere of Blue Over You just happened the other day, and it will play until the 28th of January at the Northminster Presbyterian Church, which is 2515 Central Park Avenue in Evanston. You can get tickets at blueoveryou.com. And thank you both for coming in. Sarah Whitney, the director, and Daniel Noonan, the very inspiring playwright.
Thanks, Dean.
Thanks
joining
so
us
much,
this
Dean.
Morning. Happy New Year to you both.
many New Year's resolutions have you broken so far?
One.
I think I'm about one also. I promised myself that I was going to eat healthier for the new year.
That's the one I broke.
Yeah, and I try to eat healthy, but every once in a while you gotta go nuts a little bit.
You make the excuse, at least I have, that, you know, gosh, it's cold out. It's really cold. I need something warm and comfortable.
I could die if I don't eat this full slab of ribs.
I had two great big burgers earlier in the week. Wow,
good for you.
Cheese, name it.
You make them yourself?
No.
You're out somewhere.
Yeah, I was out. And sweet potato fries.
Oh, those are good.
Aren't those good?
Those are good. I'm trying to decide if you were worse than head. I was. Two burgers. Wow, that's decadent.
Not in the same day.
Oh, but
one after another.
I thought you were like Wimpy from the Popeye.
Let me pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today.
Yeah, that's pretty decadent, two burgers. And it's like, what, 2 days? Two burgers in 2 days?
One Friday and the one yesterday.
those are good. A good burger? There's
and they were.
There's nothing much better than a good burger.
And sweet potato fries to go along with it.
Yeah, lots of salt.
Yeah, the salt was in a coarser salt that they serve with the fries, like sea salt.
But you put extra salt on.
No, I didn't do that. But, loaded down that burger. There was cheese and...
Oh, boy.
Bacon. Yeah.
Well,
comfort food.
Before I tell you what I did, I'm going to preface it by saying that I've worked out every other day since the new year.
I salute you. Have you really?
Which I realize is only 7 days old. That's not like, you know, a lot of working out, but I did spend at least a half an hour working out every other day. And I was out of town part of the time. You know, so I went to the gyms and the hotels and,
they all have, little centers of some sort where you can do things.
Yeah, exactly. So, I have that was my other resolution. I was going to try to work out, at least find a half an hour, because I'm a great one for making excuses of how busy I am. But really, you can't find a half an hour, fatty. You don't have a half an hour, really? So I've been able to find a half an hour every other day, and I hope to increase it, as we go along. That said...
To 35 minutes.
Well, small steps. I don't want to overdo it. That said, a friend of mine was having a birthday last night, and she likes to celebrate her birthday at Twin Anchors Restaurant.
Oh!
Do you know Twin Anchors Restaurant?
Right, a celebration.
On Sedgwick?
Sure. Yep.
They are among my favorites for the best ribs in Chicago.
And you like the ribs there?
I love their ribs there.
Mm-hmm.
Uncle Dean, I love their sauce. Their zesty sauce.
Mm-hmm.
I would put it on my hand right now and just eat it right off my hand. It's delicious. So I had a full slab of ribs last night.
A full slab.
Which I'm a little, yeah.
Now you must do the 35-minute workout.
I'm a grown man.
Are you going to work out today then, when the program's done?
Maybe.
You need to keep, you're on a roll here now. You have to keep it up.
Yeah, I might. I probably, maybe I will. I also had a baked potato. I didn't have fries. Everybody else at the table is having fries and onion rings.
And what came with the baked potato?
I just put a little barbecue sauce on it. I didn't put sour.
Barbecue sauce on a potato? That'd be pretty good.
Yeah, it was good. It was good.
No loaded with butter and sour cream and all that.
No, I didn't do that. I didn't do that. And I had a nice salad also.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Loaded with dressing.
1,000-calorie dressing. Not to mention the amount of sugar that's involved in that sauce.
Right.
That's what makes it taste so good.
And the barbecue sauce, right?
Yep.
Exactly.
Yep.
So, all you can do is try every day, right?
And we have a workout room right here in this building.
Oh, yeah. I would never go there.
We do? Yes. It's in the basement.
No.
Did you not know that there's a gym downstairs?
There is a gym downstairs.
There's a full fitness center in the lower level of this building.
Maybe I should join before we move.
I went there one time. When did it open, Schwani? 10, 15 years ago?
It was here 12 years ago.
Quite a long time ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all said, oh, wow, this is great. There's a gym in the building. And I went there one time and saw a coworker naked, and I've never been back since. I don't want to see any of my coworkers naked. If I went down there and Schwani was in the locker room, I would be traumatized for life.
So would a lot of people.
Yeah.
Naked news.
Because I imagine you're one of those chatty people in the locker room. You're not a head bob kind of, hey, buddy, how you doing? And, you know, they keep moving.
Go on your way.
Like, so how's everything going?
Yeah. So were you on the...
How was your new year? One leg up on the bench.
I did 30 reps with those 50-pound weights. Man, I'll tell you. You're
stealing towels, shoving them in his bag.
Why does Shawnee have so many towels that say Tribune Tower on them?
Just towels, no glasses.
Well, all you can do is try every day for this new year, right?
Yes.
Try to work out a little bit, try to eat with some moderation. I've been doing good otherwise. I think you gotta, every once in a while, you gotta be bad. And then, you know, most of the time you gotta be good. But every once in a while, have your full slab of ribs. Every once in a while, have your burger.
Otherwise, you will fall off the wagon.
Yeah, you gotta
just go crazy.
You gotta do it once in a while. And then, I think I do pretty well the rest of the time with salads and small portions is my thing now.
The smaller portion thing?
Yeah, I've been using, I don't know what you call it, like a appetizer plate.
Right.
Instead of a huge full-size plate. Smaller plate. And 9 times out of 10, I'm perfectly satisfied when I, you know, it is like 12 feet high. I do pile it up pretty high on that small plate.
Yeah, we can't go out, we go up, right?
Right.
Just like, yeah.
So that's a little bit of a challenge.
Pizza's my downfall.
Oh, pizza's good. Pizza's good. Pizza's my friend.
I have, you know, there are a few pizzas I don't like. So that's my problem.
See, kind of my award show tradition, the Golden Globes are tonight, and sort of my tradition for watching all the award shows.
Is to watch them with a big dinner?
I order a pizza.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, I mean, I guess it's a pizza and salad. But it's pizza.
Yeah.
And I don't know if I can watch the award show tonight without having pizza.
Veggie pizza.
I'm pretty healthy with the toppings. But it's still pizza. And it's still, you know, nothing but cheese and nothing but...
A lot of dough.
A lot of dough and all that. But it's, you know, it's like your tradition... you know, it's habitual. I've always said that, like, you know, weight management is mostly in your head more than your stomach.
Yeah, I'll go.
Does that make sense?
Ahead. Yeah.
So I don't know what I'm going to do tonight.
Well,
see if I'm going to go with the pizza tonight or, have some kale and watch. Sounds like a fun night.
With a little parsley on the side.
Yeah, that sounds like maybe have some quinoa and kale and watch the award show tonight. Woo! Who wants to come over? Nobody.
We'll just stay home.
Yeah, don't blame them. Don't blame them for that. How much was that lottery, the lottery winner 7?
Let's see. The one in New Hampshire was $570
million. $570 simoleons.
And the store that sold it just gets $35,000.
That's not bad, though.
It's not bad.
That's not bad for doing nothing except selling a ticket.
Yeah. And the one in Florida the day before was something like $450 million.
Yeah, that's pretty nice. Single winners for both, right?
Yes, as far as definitely in New Hampshire, and it's as near as I can tell, the one in Florida is single winners. Yep.
Have you ever thought about, seriously, I mean, what would I do if I won? What would you do if you won?
What would I do?
Sam, what would you do if you
won? Well, I'd pay my back bills.
You won $570 million. What would you do?
I don't know. I have no idea.
I would pay my bills.
Well, that, yeah, of course.
I would take care of my family. I would want to make sure that, you know, like my nieces and nephews are going to be able to go to college and all that. And then, but beyond that, do you set up businesses to, you know, do you start going completely charitable? I would like to think that I would do that. I can't imagine how many people would start coming out of the woodwork who are suddenly my best friends.
Oh, that happens.
You know, people you hadn't heard from in years. Yeah, all with their hands out. Hey, buddy.
You were casual friends with and, you know, didn't really get along with. Yeah. And then 30 years later.
Hey, buddy, I know I haven't talked to you in 30 years, but...
How are you? You know, I've been meaning to talk to you about something.
Has anybody actually, I mean, anyone listening, has anyone had that experience? Not necessarily 570 million, but, you know, if you did win that
amount. Even if they won Little Lotto, you know,
yeah,
$100,000.
Has anyone won the lottery, whatever the amount, and really what was it like? What was the experience like? Did you have people coming out of the woodwork like that? What did you do? What would you do if you were, you know, if you were this person, seriously, what would you actually do? And how do you think it would affect your life? I would love it. I mean, it would be great to win that much money. I would like to think that my life wouldn't really change that much, except I wouldn't have to worry about, where's the next paycheck coming from? But I wouldn't want my life to change. I wouldn't buy a mansion in Beverly Hills, Schwanee, with the cement pond.
The cement pond? With all your critters?
With my critters, I wouldn't do that.
Would you hang up the phone if I called you?
Mm-hmm.
And I was real nice?
More than I do now?
Yeah.
So bring towels for the pool party.
That all say Tribune Tower. 312-981-7200.
In life for free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money.
11:24, Dean Richards, Sunday morning. GM, I have not heard this song in 100 years.
That's what I want.
Money, that's what I want. The Flying Lizards.
Your love.
As they used to be called. 312-981-7200. So if you suddenly came into a lot of money, like somebody did in New Hampshire, $570 million, what would you do? Paxton, good morning. You're on WGN.
That's what I want.
Hi, guys. I enjoy the show.
Thank you. So what? You actually won the lottery 20 years ago, it says.
Yeah, but it was 20,000. It wasn't the big one. You know, it was a scratch off.
That's still 20,000. Is it a one-time hit? 20,000?
Yeah. You just cash it in and then you pay the taxes. So I got like, I think 17, maybe.
Not too bad for purchasing a lottery ticket. So how did your life change, if at all?
Well, I acted like a big shot and blew it like 4,000 or 5,000 of it, you know, and then.
Like, for example, when you say that you blew 4,000 or 5,000on what?
Oh, I don't want to say. I mean, just, you know, booze and babe, mostly.
Okay. All right. I got you.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Then I realized that I started hanging out, like, thinking I was rich. And then you're not rich. When you win 20,000, you're not rich. You know, you start thinking you are, and it was an embarrassment. And then I just stopped playing because it's just a fool's game. I mean, if you win, it is gonna ruin.
There could be some negative consequences. Sure, we've heard stories like that many times through the years. So if you had won more than 20,000, would it have been even worse for you? Because you really could have gone crazy with more than 17 grand.
Yeah. I was thinking about the guys I was listening to last night on WGN, and they were talking about everybody that ruined their lives, you know, buying or winning the millions and ruining their lives. You know, I didn't do that. You know, I ended up giving it, you know, to some, you know, mostly Red Cross, because I love Red Cross.
Right.
They're the best. And, you know, but I, you know, you blow it and then you give some away, and but no one called me. You know, no one's going to call you for that amount of money. Only if you win more than that. You know, no one called me and begged me for money.
Right.
But it's
interesting. That's very interesting though, because everybody thinks, boy, if I could only just hit the numbers. You know, if I could, my it would be set. And you know, the moral to your story is, you know, maybe not so much.
It tests you. It tests you as how strong your character is.
Yeah. Okay.
And you know, it was only 20,000 with a scratch off, and then they take all that out of it, so it's really not that much. I mean, you have to read poetry or something before you. Yeah. And it's more important to do that.
Yeah, I get you. I get
you. That money.
Paxton, thanks for the call. Really interesting. Yeah. I appreciate that very much. Have a great day. Jerry, hi, you're on WGN.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well. What would you do if you won, hit the lotto?
Disconnect my phone.
You would disconnect your phone?
Yeah, I'd be doing all the calling. I wouldn't have anybody calling me.
Oh, I got So you get yourself a big, fat, unlisted phone then, right?
Sure, get one in pay-as-you-go phones or something like that.
Okay, because you don't want anybody calling you trying to get some of your money.
No, for sure. I'd be doing all the calling.
What would you spend some of that money on, do you think?
Oh, I always thought about, you know, doing a charity thing with the kids and stuff like that.
Right.
I thought about getting a motorhome and just traveling the country. That's it. At this time of my life, you know.
Yeah.
Years ago, it would have been a whole lot different, but not now.
I got you. You think maybe like our previous caller, where you know there could have been some instant pleasure, shall we say?
Sure. I'm not interested now. Things have happened to me that all that fun stuff is not that important.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. A little life experience teaches you a lot. I appreciate your call, Jerry. Thank you very much for checking in. Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you very much. 312-981-7200. Here is one that says, first, you should go to a lawyer, then an accountant, then a financial advisor. Then you set up a business to set up a foundation and manage the money for request for funds. Think of Bill Gates and his foundation. You'd have to run a business. Here's another that says, I would save the dogs. Save the dogs. All right. Here's another that says, I wouldn't tell anyone if I was the winner. Let's go to, we had somebody who was going to buy a car. Yeah, take care of some of the basics in life. I think that's the bottom line of this, right? Take care of the basics, pay your bills, take care of kids and charities and all that, and then just try to manage it to make it last as long as possible. 312-981-7200. I gave the girl legs on me. Wani, are you ready to have your mind blown?
Wow.
What we are listening to right now.
I think I know where you're going with this.
This is a 1929 recording of baby Rose Marie. A 5-year-old Rose Marie, who we know best from the Dick Van Dyke Show. Well, listen to her.
She had it down.
5 years old, and she was, you know, basically imitating, you know, one of the hottest performers of the day, Sophie Tucker, who was a little bit provocative on stage. Here comes this 5-year-old, you know, singing like this on stage and knocking them crazy on vaudeville stages all over America. And that, for Rose Marie Mazzetta, led to a regular radio show back in the day. And she became literally one of the most popular performers in America at age 5. And it continued from radio to the movies and Broadway. Along the way, some very interesting Chicago connections. But what we know Rose Marie best for is playing Sally Rogers, the man-hungry comedy writer on the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Hi, Sally. Hi. Here's a plastic spaceship for Richie and a 5-pound box of candy for you, and let's not waste any more time. Where is he? How do you do? I'm Sally Rogers. Are you still single?
Am I still what?
Sally, this is my cousin, Thomas Edson. Thomas Edson?
Oh,
well, you did a great job on that light bulb, Tom.
So funny on Dick Van Dyke Show, as we know. But also starring on the old Doris Day Show and a regular for many years on the Hollywood Squares. She would go back to Broadway in a review called Four Girls Four and do a variety of television appearances. Very, very active until her death last week. The great Rosa Marie is the subject of a documentary that fortunately she was able to see before she passed away called Wait for Your Laugh that will open here in Chicago next week. It'll play at Facets on West Fullerton, and the director of Wait for Your Laugh, Jason Wise, joins us on the phone line right now. Jason, hi, thank you for joining us. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you guys. Thank you for having me up.
I can only imagine how much fun it must have been to put together this documentary. It is so entertaining. The kind of entertainment that Rosemary gave us for all of these decades.
Yeah, I can tell you that this, I have never had a more, yeah, definitely fun, but a more rewarding experience making a film. Absolutely. And you know, the funny thing is she was just astoundingly hilarious in person. I mean, probably funnier than she was as a character on the show she was on. She's a very witty person.
I can imagine. One of the things that really impressed me when I saw the film was how well documented her life was, both with old film clips and old kinescopes and old photographs. I mean, virtually every moment of her life was documented somehow because she started in show business at such a young age.
Yeah, and she did something very unique. What she did when she had, she wasn't given a lot of money by the people, I would say, as a child star, kind of cared for her. But what she did with her money was she bought a camera, and she took photos of everything. And she continued that practice into her teens when she was one of the first people that I know of that bought an 8mm camera and a 16mm camera, and she was shooting color film, you know, in the late 30s and the 40s. I mean, some of the footage in our film, we argued, should we turn it black and white so people believe it's real? Because she was shooting, you know, Kodak's very first color film. She just was what people do nowadays with their phones and just sort of shoot everything.
Yeah.
She was kind of doing that as a teenager at that age, and it was a really rare thing. So, yeah, we had a mountain of footage to work with.
Yeah, I'm so glad you didn't turn it black and white because it's that very cool, very stylized, you know, color. It's like, you know, the early days of color film that, you know,
absolutely.
Isn't quite real looking, but it's so cool because it represents, you know, that certain era. Talk to me a little bit about Rosemary's evolution from 5-year-old child star to becoming one of the favorites of the mob, including Chicago's very own Al Capone, who she called Uncle Al.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. She came about a time when vaudeville, people look at that time and they don't think it's a lot like today, but it really is. I mean, if you look at like YouTube stars and how they just blow up out of nowhere, it was a lot like that at the time. If you had a catchy thing you did and you could be a vaudeville star and word would spread and you could sell tickets, you could blow up quickly. And Rosemary had this, as you know, this voice that sounded like an older woman, and she was 4. And so she sold a lot of tickets, and it was mostly she became famous on radio at the age of 4. And they put her in the last vaudeville theaters to sort of prove that she was actually a kid. And she traveled the entire country from the years 4, 5, and 6 years old. I mean, she got her education from performers on the road. I mean, we're talking George Burns and Gracie Allen and the Ritz brothers, and people who were some of the more famous people in the country at the time, were the ones who taught her how to exist. And, of course, at that time, and as you guys well know in Chicago, the world was not run by Disney like it is now. So most of these clubs, these vaudeville centers, even the radio, it was a very, very mob-oriented scene. And her father, I'm not giving away too much in the film here, her father was an arsonist for the lesser part of Al Capone's operation in Chicago. And he was not a great guy. He was based in New Jersey, but back and forth between Chicago, New Jersey, Cleveland. And he sort of saw a huge buck in Rosemary and took her all around, and she made a lot of money. And then she moved to nightclubs. And in doing the nightclub scene, you know, nowadays we watch everything on Netflix, but people used to have to actually go and watch someone perform. And as she did this, she had this evolution where she started doing comedy. And during the film, you can kind of see the change in her. And if you're familiar with her from the Dick Van Dyke Show, and you have this hard-nosed, hard woman who's very funny and witty, and it's kind of a funny thing to watch that evolve, because she was this very pretty, very elegant singer in the early 40s. And then she became what we all know by figuring out a comedy act and incorporating that into her music. And so, you know, you're talking about somebody who very naturally, over the course of 90 years, was able to stay true to what they were born with as a singer and a performer, but also she was one of, if not the very first women who was telling, I don't want to say like masculine jokes, but I mean, there was no difference between her and a lot of the male comedians at the time.
Yeah, very.
So for her evolution, yeah, it was astounding.
Very, very much. I mean, obviously she admired Jimmy Durante. There was a very similar style. In fact, she kind of paid tribute to him in her act, but it was sort of that rough around the edges, like a tough dame, don't mess with me kind of demeanor about her, which I'm guessing was pretty much true life if she was raised, you know, in backstages of theaters, you know, kind of coddled and protected by the mob. And, you know, showbiz types. I'm guessing that, you know, she grew up as kind of in the school of hard knocks.
Yeah, she certainly did. I mean, Rosemary, you know, and even dealing with her myself, you know, I became very close friends with her. She does not hold her opinion back. There are no punches pulled with this person. And so, and I say that in the most complimentary way I can. She's not difficult. She's not somebody who would go out of her way to be tough. She just was tough. She walked the walk. And so, you know, in the film, when she goes up against Bugsy Siegel and yells at him because of, you know, a few dollars are missing from a paycheck, she's not joking. She's somebody who, you know, and, you know, when she gets to the Dick Van Dyke Show and plays this character, you can, once you know that she went toe-to-toe with Al Capone and with, you know, there's a lot of monsters that aren't in the film that she knew intimately, you know, from Cincinnati and Miami and all this stuff. She really was respected as one of them, and she made them all a lot of money, and so they loved her. I mean, it was really, Hard Knocks is an understatement for her. She really was, you know, she could have been the coach of an NFL team.
Yeah. We could use her in Chicago right now. That we need somebody like that. But through all of that toughness and through all of her, you know, hard exterior, was a sensitive, vulnerable person who was devastated when the love of her life passed away. Let me take a quick break. And we'll talk about that and her years on the Dick Van Dyke Show, remembering Sally Rogers in this new documentary that I'm urging you to see. I'm sad that it's only going to be here in Chicago for a week. I hope that it gets extended, but it's set to play at Facets at 1517 West Fullerton, January 12th through the 18th. I'll tell you more how to get tickets for that in a couple of minutes as we continue with its director, Jason Wise, when we come back on WGN.
I want to be around to pick up the pieces when somebody breaks your heart, when somebody twice as smart as I.
11:52, Dean Richards, Sunday morning on WGN, remembering the late Rose Marie. New documentary, Wait for Your Laugh, talks about her career from childhood all the way up until her death, really, last week. This is a clip from the Dick Van Dyke Show, where we would occasionally see the man crazy Sally Rogers get up on a stage you know, and sing a song. Little did most of us know at the time that that was her main thing. So getting up and singing a song is was her claim to fame long before she ever came to the Dick Van Dyke Show. So Jason Wise, the director of the film, is on the line with us. So both being this man-hungry woman, completely being untrue, and, you know, being a primarily a singer, not comedian, untrue, Jason, as we find out. In 1946, she marries a trumpet player with the Bing Crosby band named Bobby Guy, who she, you know, has described many times through the years as being the love of her life.
Yeah, Bobby, you know, Bobby was, and I say this with no exaggeration, I think he's one of the most underrated trumpet players or probably even musicians America's ever produced. And he came at the wrong time. He came before Miles Davis, and, you know, there was really, like, Gene Krupa was out. There was no Buddy Rich, really, at this point. You know, there weren't musicians who were made the band famous. It was generally, you know, Bing Crosby, the vocalist, you know, yeah, the band leader. Yeah. And so, but Bobby Guy was just an absolutely insane talent. It was very exciting to be able to shed light on that kind of studio musician in this movie. But she adored him and loved him. And that's the thing that I think surprises a lot of people who are big fans of the Dick Van Dyke Show, is that this woman was, in a very strange way, a 50s housewife as well, as being a kind of blue-collar showbiz star. And she, I can't tell you enough in this film or on this phone call how much she loved him and how much he loved her. This, I came to my wife, who produced and wrote the film with me, and I said, I have the greatest mob movie we're ever going to make. And she read her story, and she said, no, we have the greatest love story we're ever going to make. And we kind of went back and forth and realized, I think it's Bobby and the love story in this film that really makes it what it is, you know, really holds it together.
It really, it shows a sensitive side of her that, you know, we never really had heard before. And to just to shine some light on Bobby Guy, of what an amazing performer he was, but also, you know, think about this, a husband in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, who didn't mind that his wife was the, you know, was the star, was the one that everybody recognized.
Yeah, yeah, and, you know, that's, I think that that bothered Rosemary quite a bit throughout her performance. She wanted Bobby to get the credit he deserved, and Bobby was very much, he didn't mind, you know, having a wife who made more money than him, and he didn't mind. He was very happy with his talent. I mean, it's very progressive, you know, if you look at it from that standpoint. And it's part of why I think this film is just so important for people today to see that, you know, that's okay. It's not, it yeah. doesn't have to be, you know, very traditional, because it wasn't always that way.
Yeah, well, and so opposite of her, you know, persona as Sally Rogers on the Dick Van Dyke Show. What were those years like for her? Because, you know, if you look at the cast of Dick Van Dyke, and this even includes Carl Reiner at the time, who was a young producer, she really was the one with all the experience. She was the one with, you know, the showbiz credibility. Everybody else were all, you know, pretty much young upstarts, talented as heck. But she was the one. She was the one. She and Maury Amsterdam were the veterans, really.
Absolutely. You know, it's so funny in retrospect. People don't realize the first season was a flop. It was the first season of the Dick Van Dyke Show was probably the most stressful year of Carl Reiner's life. You know, they did so many episodes back then. It wasn't like, you know, a 12 episode season or 8 episode season like they do today. I mean, they did 26 episodes, something like that. It was wild, 28. And it was absolutely a failure. And it wasn't until they went on reruns in the summer that it sort of picked up an audience. And they took a big risk on that, didn't make any money, and it worked. That gamble paid off. But you're absolutely right. They hired Rosemary to kind of play that grizzled, been-there kind of comedy writer. And she had been working three lifetimes compared to, I mean, Mary Tyler Moore had done some theater. But she was she was a nobody at that point. And Dick will say it, and he says it many times throughout the film. I mean, they were... Who is this guy? I mean, when Maury and Rosemary found out they were going to work on this show called The Dick Van Dyke Show, their first thing was they thought that name was a made-up character, because who had ever heard of a headliner named Dick Van Dyke? He was a nobody.
Right.
And that's the big joke. And so the film itself you know, in that section, Rosemarie, and Dick says this constantly, is he wouldn't have comedy timing. He wouldn't understand how to perform, say a joke, wait for the punchline, and that's where the film's title comes from, Wait for Your Laugh, if Rosemarie and Maury, to a lesser extent, had not taught him how to do that. And it's astounding when you think of one of the greatest physical comedians that we have learning his trade from somebody like Rosemarie, who was educated, like you said, in the back rooms of theaters. I mean, she didn't go to school. She didn't go to Juilliard. This is a woman who picked this up from vaudevillians.
Yeah.
She learned how to juggle from a vaudevillian. She learned how to, you know, and she earned her credit on the street. So you put her in the Dick Van Dyke Show, and she's surrounded by all these people who did learn on Broadway. They learned in, like, the more classic ways you would do it at school. And so I think you wouldn't have Mary Tyler Moore, and you wouldn't have Dick Van Dyke, and you wouldn't have even, you know, to some degree, Carl Reiner and their success if they hadn't been rubbing elbows with Rosemarie, and I'm sure fighting as much as they did.
Well, I wonder what the relationship was like, because one of the things that's disclosed in the movie is that Rosemarie thought that the premise of the show was going to be centered more on the three writers in the writing room. And as the show developed and evolved, it became more of a family comedy that was as much in the Petrie's home in New Rochelle as it was in the writing room of the Alan Brady Show.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, she was absolutely right. At the beginning, it was a show about comedy writers. It really was. And you can watch the evolution happen as you watch the seasons. But America chose Mary Tyler Moore. There's no question about it. America fell, and rightly so. She's beautiful, talented, you know, just a wonderful, wonderful force. But I will also say, imagine being Rosemarie. You're the veteran. You are pretty much the first woman on television to be given equal treatment. You're not a mother. You're not a wife. You're not a daughter. You're not a maid. You're in the writer's room working in a profession that's completely male-dominated, holding your own. And here comes this young girl, and she's getting credit in all the major newspapers and magazines for being progressively female, for wearing pants. Imagine if you're Rosemarie and that's happening. So, of course, the two of them are going to have some serious friction. And it's not Mary Tyler Moore's fault. You know, like I said, America fell in love with them as a couple. And so I think it really made her feel a third wheel when she was the second get for the show behind Dick Van Dyke. It's like she was the second star.
Yeah, I want to talk about that more. Jason, can you hang on for a couple of more minutes? We need to do the news, and I want to come back after the news and talk a little bit more about that. And I'm sure ultimately resolving in her head, you know, this whole conflict about the Dick Van Dyke Show and some of the things that she did after the Dick Van Dyke Show as well. Jason Wise is the director of this great documentary, Wait for Your Laugh. Facets, January 12th through 18th here in Chicago, 1517 West Fullerton. I don't know if you have favorite Dick Van Dyke Show episodes specifically related to Rosemarie, Sally Rogers, on the show, but I just used to love when the three of them would be in the comedy office, you know, and it was just like the guys hanging out, and she held her own.
She did.
You know, and you think about this was the early 60s. And, you know, women had a different kind of role on television then. She truly was one of a kind back then, yet was always this looking for a man, you know, kind of guy.
Do you remember who her off and on boyfriend was?
Howard Glimcher.
Herman Glimcher.
Herman Glimcher.
Herman Glimcher.
Herman Glimcher. One of my favorite episodes was called The Life and Love of Joe Coogan, where an old friend of Laura's comes over to the house for dinner. Only now he's a priest.
Yeah, right.
And Rob didn't know that. Invites Sally over, thinking there could be a little love connection going on.
Some romance.
Speaking of surprises, I invited Sally over for dinner.
Sally's coming here?
Yeah, I wanted her to meet Father Coogan.
Rob, where is she?
Well, she's followed me in her car. She should be here about any minute now. I'll set another place.
Well, that's all right. Gee, darling, I sure wish you told me Sally was coming.
Yeah, well, she'd tell me something once in a while. I'll try to stop her before she gets in the door.
Would you?
Yeah,
Sally's here.
Yeah, well,
hi.
Hi, sir.
I'll see all you two later. Where's this tall, good-looking, charming priest you want to hear?
It's such a great episode. She discovers him, you know, he stands up and he's wearing a collar. Jason Wise is the director of the documentary Wait for Your Laugh. Did Rose ever talk to you, Jason, about her favorite episodes on the Dick Van Dyke Show?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of talked about that. I mean, obviously, the quick answer would be the ones that sort of focused on the writers and her and Maury. And that, I mean, it's an easy answer, but that's pretty much what she said.
But no episodes in particular that she loved more than most?
I think the episode Sally the Girl. I don't know if you remember that episode where basically they keep... it's kind of an episode where they keep making Sally a guy, essentially. They invite her to a poker game that's only for men. They do all these things, and then they decide, okay, like a lot of other episodes, we need to find her a date, you know? There's another episode where she falls in love with Dick Van Dyke, or at least that Dick and Laura think that she's in love with him. And it's those episodes where she got a chance to actually act. And then definitely the ones where she got to perform. You know, there were several episodes where she got to actually sing on the show.
Right.
She did her Durante impression. I think those above all, where she got to show how, you know, three-dimensional she was as a performer, I think she really, really, really was happy to do that. And when Maury got to do his jokes and stuff like that, I think that would be the answer. You know, she sang Cotton Fields on the show, and she sang, you know, I think that's was really special for her.
Yeah, after seeing the documentary, it sure does put a whole different light on, you know, the occasional episode where Sally would perform, like in the living room of the Petri home or, you know, something like that. It was clearly, let's let this great veteran shine with, you know, yeah, with what she's famous for.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it, too, was Rosemarie really putting the screws in Carl's thumbs that she wanted to, too. I mean, I think there was she would tell me that on a daily basis, she would tell Carl, I don't have enough to do. I don't have enough to do. Huh. I don't have it. And finally, you know, through situational, you know, most of the time she performed, it would always be through some situational comedy that she would have to entertain a very important guest and something got messed up. And so they would call her in to sing
right.
And keep them busy or something. But the minute she would start singing, it's like all of a sudden, like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, it would sort of take the entire plot as a second fiddle to her performance. And I mean, she would always be on Carl. I want more to do. I want more to do. And I think that's where those performances came from.
Yeah. Would you say that she thought that her years doing that show were happy ones? It sounds like it was fairly frustrating.
I will speak as the outsider who spent hours and weeks and months and years going through her materials, speaking with her, speaking with everyone else on the show. I would not say particularly they were happy. I mean, obviously, I don't want to ruin too much about the film, but you know, she has issues with her husband's health during it, which were devastating to her. But aside from that, there was an extreme frustration from the show. And I have to say, Rosemarie was not somebody who wanted a lot of credit. So it's not that she wasn't the most important person. I have to say, you know, she had a healthy ego like anybody who performs, but she was she just wanted to work, and she wanted to, I mean, that was her mantra. So I want to make it very clear. She wasn't somebody who was upset she wasn't getting credit. She was upset that she was sitting on a chair, not performing. And so I think that was very frustrating for her, especially later on in the show when she, you know, when it became very, very Laura and,
right.
You know, very Dick Van Dyke and Mary focused. And I think also where a lot of people looked at the Dick Van Dyke show as the pinnacle of their career, I think Rosemarie thought of it as another job at the time. I mean, for her, this right. was not going to work the same way. You know, any show you do ends. And I think when you start when you're three, and you're at the age she was in the 60s on the show, for her it was another job. Even if that thing would have gone 8 years, she would have still had to end it and get another gig afterwards.
Right.
So whereas Mary Tyler Moore and all these people, they look at it as this is what started my career, this is what made me famous, and I would have nothing without it. For her, it was
just,
here's another job.
Just
I got
another stop. Yeah.
Jobs.
Right.
Yeah. And I think it's a very different mentality, and I think somebody with her kind of pedigree is allowed to think that way. But I would not say they were the happiest of times for her. They were certainly not the saddest, but I mean, you know, the issues with her husband made it close to that. For
yeah.
Sure.
Her husband passed away while she was doing the Dick Van Dyke Show, right?
Yeah, and I will say, you know, when you're trying to tell somebody's story, and I'm not giving, you know, too much away from the film, when you're trying to tell somebody's story, and it encompasses so many things and such a long period of time, and that one event of, you know, anyone who's lost somebody, they truly, truly don't know how to exist without, and I'm sure many people listening have, you don't know how to get back to do your, you don't know how to do your job. You don't know how to do simple things anymore, you know? And for that event to take place in the film, it was very hard to show the Dick Van Dyke Show with all of its importance, but then also give weight to that event. And the fact that that happened to her on the show, and she had to go back to work and be this funny,
be funny,
single right. person. Oh, my God. And then, you know, that's why we devote so much of the show and to that topic. Because nowadays, when something like that happens to a celebrity, it is so public that you can't see that person without knowing that that happened. But Rosemary kept this. This was not, she didn't want this to define her. She didn't want it to bog down the show. She's a consummate professional. And I think, I admire her so much. And I think everybody who watches the documentary is definitely going to walk away with a different perspective on her character and on Carl's writing and everybody being able to have the event that happened and yet still have the show continue the way it did. I don't know that many people could pull that off like Rosemary did.
Yeah, well, it's that old, you know, showbiz trooper. The show must go on, no matter what happens. And, you know, the most devastating thing that could possibly happen to her happened. And then she had to show back up at work and, you know, be funny and laugh with the boys and, you know, be, you know, somebody who's hungry to find a husband and, you know, like every single thing that must have been tearing her heart apart. But the show went on at the same time. 312-981-7200 is our phone number. If you've got questions for Jason Wise, the director of the documentary Wait for Your Laugh, Rosemary's Story. And this is Stacy. Hi, you're on WGN.
Oh, good morning, gentlemen. Happy Sunday to you.
Happy Sunday. Thank you.
Thank you for taking my call. Mr. Wise, thank you so much for making a documentary about Rosemary, who is by far one of my favorite comedians. Very underrated, I think. And my very favorite show. I have every disc of the Dick Van Dyke Show that I watch over and over. My two favorite, and I can't, the titles elude me right now. One where she talks about her cat, Mr. Henderson, and why his name is Mr. Henderson. And shows a very vulnerable side of Ms. Marie. That show was basically, you know, about her, and it was her birthday, I believe it was, and she wanted to stay home, and her friends came out to coax her along. Amazing effort. I can't watch it and not shed a tear, because I knew what she was going through during that time of the Dick Van Dyke Show, because I read so much about the show. The other one is with the delicatessen man, Bert Munker. He would bring her a rose every day.
Right.
And the two tickets to the theater, and Laura ended up going. But my thing, it's not really a question, sir, but just to say thank you, and I can't wait to see this documentary. Now, it's a very short span of time, and my work schedule is a little muddled. If I can't make it, will it be available to see elsewhere? Can I purchase it? Because this is something I would want to watch over and over again anyway.
Yeah, Jason, everybody on our text line is asking, you know, will it be on cable? Will it be on Netflix? Will it be available someplace if they can't get to the facets next week?
Yeah, absolutely. So it will, you know, Rosemary was 94 when she passed away, and it's strange to say that was very sudden for us. You would think if somebody was 94, you would expect it, but, I mean, you know, it was very sudden. We didn't expect it. So we are scrambling at the moment to make sure that that will happen. And the answer is absolutely. You know, we will get it out far and wide. But I made a promise to her when I first started this that I wasn't making a TV show. I was making a movie, and it would go in theaters. And so we put a lot of effort into making sure this had a theatrical run, market by market. And it meant a lot to her, you know, that I actually fulfilled that promise. And but the answer is absolutely. We will have a wonderful DVD. We're working on TV sales, all that stuff. faster than we thought we were going to.
Is it possible that it might be at facets longer than the 1 week, or might wind up, say, at our Music Box Theater here in Chicago? This sounds like something that the Music Box would run for.
Yeah, we wanted to play at the Music Box. I mean, in fact, it's a wonderful place. I'm so honored to play there. But we wanted to play, you know, it's a scheduling thing because we're in the middle of Oscar season. Mm. Theaters are just slammed. I will tell you, absolutely, if people show up this weekend, it will absolutely stay there. It all depends on opening weekend. And that is, that's how this goes, you know. But if people come out, and you tell your grandparents and your kids and your kids' dogs, and everybody shows up and the weather's not too bad, the answer is absolutely. It will absolutely stay.
Well, at least our Arctic blast is easing up a little bit. That should be.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you this. Rose Marie's she loved Chicago in a way that I can't express to you guys. I mean, she adored the city. She worked there so much. I've certainly obviously never met anybody who witnessed the changing landscape of Chicago as much as she did. I mean, Rosemary knew half the city is, you know, there were cows in a lot of places. It was a very different place, and Cicero was what it was. And, I mean, it was a very important city for her, and she got thousands of times performed there. So
yeah, outside of the Al Capone Cicero connection, but she just played all the big nightclubs here back in the day.
Absolutely. I mean, Chicago was the convention city, as her and Peter Marshall would always tell me. There was no Vegas. You know, Vegas is the convention city now, but it wasn't the case. It was Chicago. Chicago was where all the railroads led to. It was where all the transportation went to, and it was the center of the universe. It was everything for entertainment. I mean, New York was one thing, but it wasn't the center. The center was Chicago. And so, you know, that's where everything came from. And, you know, this is a huge thing for her to play in Chicago, and obviously it is for me. So.
Yeah, talking about Vegas, in the film, you learn about Rose Marie's role in Vegas becoming what it has begun, what it has become. I don't want to give too much away with all of that, but she was one of the very first performers to be there, and her involvement in the early days of Vegas is very, very interesting. Here's Terry on the phone line at 312-981-7200. Hi, you're on WGN.
Hey, Happy New Year from Texas.
Happy New Year from Texas. Where in Texas?
I'm in Dallas. Lived in Chicago for a million years, but moved back here and still listen to you every weekend.
Thank you so much.
And I am so happy to hear this conversation today. I've been looking for this movie around here for at least a couple months. I thought it was supposed to open in November, but I haven't been able to find it anywhere. Wondering if y'all could tell me if I have any chance of seeing it here.
Thanks for throwing in a y'all also, by the way.
Well, it's not throwing, it's just natural.
Just to make it sound a little more Texas-y.
Hey, it's honest to goodness.
I appreciate it. Jason, do you know the schedule, if it's going to be in Dallas?
Yeah, we're working very hard on Texas. Texas and Florida have been tough because of, again, with the Oscar stuff and the sheer amount of films that have come out in the last. I mean, we pushed this thing into theaters again. Some of the subjects in our film, you know, we had this kind of joke going that if you were under 90, you couldn't be in the movie. And and it ends up, it's not really a joke. I mean, Peter Marshall, Tim Conway, Carl Reiner, Dick Van Dyke, Rosemary. I mean, you're talking, you know, no spring chickens in this movie. So we really pushed it into theaters so that everybody could see it happen. You know, everybody has done press and been wonderful and amazing, and I think we, as what happened with Rosemary the other week, you know, proves, we were right to do that. But Texas, we are working very hard on, I promise you. In fact, I have family in Dallas who have yelled at me on a constant basis about this exact topic. So I am, I can tell you that I'm trying.
Is there a website for the film, Jason, so people can kind of keep track of, you know, where it'll be playing?
Yeah, waitforyourlaugh.com is where we have all of that stuff up. So if you go to waitforyourlaugh.com, you can find showtimes and all that stuff. But again, we are truly working on home video as hard as we can at the moment, and should have answers on that very soon.
Well, we have a wonderful film center here in Dallas called the Angelica. Would love to see it there.
Yeah, I know there's some.
Yes, you know, we played at the Angelica in New York, and also their pop-up in Washington. So that is a very good possibility. I will talk to them.
Right. Okay, I'll keep my fingers crossed. Thanks so much.
Terry, thank you. Thank you for listening. We all appreciate it. We all appreciate you all.
Well, no, it's not you all. It's y'all.
Y'all. Sorry, I'll get the hang.
I get it right, Ding.
I'll get the hang of it eventually.
All right.
Thanks, Terry.
Thank you.
Happy New Year to you. Thank you very much. Jason, tell me how involved was Rosemary herself in the making of this film? Because I know it was completed before her death last week.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, she's done Q&As. I mean, she's done tons of press. In fact, she was supposed to do an interview for the Chicago Sun-Times, I think, the day she passed away. So not only has she seen it many, many times, but she, you know, helped promote it. I was given the greatest gift in my professional career, and it will probably never happen again, by Rosemary. When she saw my wife and I and our partner Jackson, who makes the films with us, we're dead serious about making this the right way. She sort of looked at me and she said, don't mess me around. Make an honest movie. Don't, you know, put the warts in, put it all in, but make it a good movie. You know, she didn't want a tribute film.
Yeah.
And the film's greatest strength to me as a filmmaker is that she's alive in it. There's so many of these movies, the Johnny Carson film, the this, the that. They wait until, you know, the person has passed away, and they wait 4 or 5 years or 10 years, and then finally the family says, okay, and they make a film, and they are heavily involved in what can be said and what can't be said. Well, Rosemary doesn't pull any punches. Rosemary doesn't care that people think she's tough and this and that. And I mean, and this made it terrifying to us to show her the film, by the way, because she had seen nothing except done a ton of interviews. I mean, it was very, scary for us to show her the movie, but she had.
What was her reaction when the, you know, the credits come up, lights go on? What did she say?
So we did a private screening at her house with very close family. Her daughter and I worked very close through the process. You know, her daughter was a television producer, and so it was a little scary to say okay. But I showed her the first complete cut, and amazingly, her daughter loved it. We couldn't believe it. So we got together this screening at her house, and Peter Marshall came over and sat next to her, and it had about 25 very intimate people. We knew she needed to see it with an audience. We couldn't just show it to her alone, or she'd be in her own head about it. She needed to feed off if there was laughter in the room. And so she sat there with Peter Marshall, and they held hands the entire movie.
Uh-huh.
And she was laughing. I mean, I have never been more nervous to show anybody anything. So the lights come up, and her and Peter are both crying. And Peter Marshall, he got the first words in, and he said, I feel like nobody ever needs to make a movie about me because this film was my career, too. You know, going through the nightclubs and all this stuff. And they both cried. I mean, it was an astounding, cathartic situation for us as filmmakers. She really... And she laughed so... Anytime anybody says anything bad about her, she laughed so hard. I mean, it was not what you would expect. There was no, she's very sentimental in the way that she cares about the past and cares about people who helped her. But she also is a realist in that, you know, you can't go through life without making a few people angry, and it's good to laugh at that. You know, it was a very good experience. That was her response.
Yeah. And plus, I'm sure she's heard it all through the years of, you know, every kind of reaction that there can possibly be, and has learned to get through it all somehow.
You have to understand, I don't think a lot of people, Carl included, I don't think when he first saw the film in Dick, and Dick Van Dyke, I showed, that was the second screening. We did a at the Aero Theater in Los Angeles, and there was, you know, 300 people. And Dick and Carl saw it for the first time. It was my second nervous time showing, second most scared time showing the film. They couldn't believe they didn't know this story. I mean, they worked with her and knew her for 60, 70 years.
Wow.
And their response was, I mean, Carl's first response is, man, I should have paid you more. It was, you know, and you're talking about a woman who didn't do drugs. She didn't drink. She was married to the same man her whole life. You know, I mean, Carl's like, how did you make a good movie out of this? You know, normally you need scandal and terrible and awful people, and, right. you know, here you have a good person. And, you know, anyways, that's, the response has meant a lot.
Well, all of that has turned into a really good movie. The documentary is called Wait for Your Laugh. It'll be playing at Facets here in Chicago January 12th through 18th. It's 1517 West Fullerton. It's just east of Ashland in Chicago. It's $10. You know, if they have a great opening weekend, maybe it'll be here longer. So get your tickets now. You can order online at, on Facets' website. But it's a real pleasure to spend some time with you, Jason. We really appreciate it. Keep us posted on what's going on, and we'll make sure everybody knows.
My God, thank you. The pleasure is all mine. Thank you.
Jason Wise, the director of Wait for Your Laugh. See, we do this because we care. We don't want anyone to get hurt. We don't want anyone to get sick.
Slick and hazardous conditions quite often can be the case this time of year, Dean.
That's why we take this extra caution. It may seem, you know, like you would know these things, but we just want to make sure that if, you know, if it's cold, bundle up.
That's right.
And as you're slippery, be careful.
And as you drive your car, the contact of the tire to the pavement is something called friction.
Right. It's not as grippy as it normally is.
And if you have a slick and hazardous condition, you will have less and less traction and friction. And therefore, you may slide if you go into a skid, turn in the direction of the skid.
That has never been better over-explained by any broadcaster in the history of...
Why this is a Peabody winning program.
That's exactly right. Also, you know, we've been eating like crazy over the holiday time, and, you know, you just feel like you want to start fresh for the new year. You know, get on the right track, lose some weight, you know, be healthier. Ran across a great article on one of my favorite websites, Epicurious.com, detox recipes that actually taste good. David Tamarkin is one of the editors at Epicurious.com. And David, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it. Well, when I hear the word detox, I recoil a little bit because that doesn't sound very tasty right there.
I know. It sounds like you're about to, like, drink blended grass or something.
Yeah, castor oil or something. Right, exactly right.
Yeah.
But these recipes look absolutely delicious.
Yeah, thanks. We tried hard to, you know, gather all the, you know, the best detox recipes we could because, to your point, nobody really wants their food to taste healthy, right? Like, we want it to taste good and be healthy. So we think these recipes fit that bill.
Yeah, so let me go down some of the recipes, and you can explain, you know, how they're detoxy, how they're cleansing, how they, you know, get you off on the right foot for the new year. The first one is a slow-roasted salmon with fennel, citrus, and chilies. Now, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, I know. This is one of my favorite ways to cook salmon, is to cook it in a slow and low, although it's not that slow. It's just slower than cooking it in a higher temp oven. And what that does is it creates a salmon that is really, really sort of almost juicy. We don't really think of that word with salmon very much, but this salmon just sort of is really luscious. And it also doesn't make your kitchen smell like fish, which is really sort of a side benefit. Anyway, here you're getting tons of citrus, so everybody knows that citrus is good for you because of all the vitamin C in that, and especially in cold weather like this, you won't have to get a cold. So that's one thing that's happening here. And also chilies are very good for you. They have all these elements that they can open up your sinuses, and they have anti-inflammatory properties as well. And I have a feeling as we have this conversation, Dean, you're going to hear me say that word anti-inflammatory a lot, because that's really a lot of the times the benefit of a lot of these recipes.
Well, that's, you know, that's an important you know, feature of a lot of these things, and kind of the rejuvenating or cleansing process of the whole thing. So when you're talking about doing the salmon low and slow, how low, how slow?
Well, so, you know, you have so many options. This recipe in particular,
you're putting your oven to 275, which is pretty low.
Right.
Now, in terms of slow, it's not that slow. It's going to take 30 to 40 minutes. You could do this. Something I like to do, so this recipe also, to note, it makes a pretty good amount of salmon. This will serve six people. But if you're just serving, you know, one or two people, I like to take just a regular fillet of salmon and use my toaster oven because, you know, set that to 275.
Oh, right.
Put just one fillet in there or two fillets in there. And you can do the same thing. Just lay some citrus spices on top of it, some chilies on it. And that will only take, like, you know, 15 minutes before it's ready. So
yeah.
It's not that slow. It's just... I guess it's just low. It's low and low.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's slower than if you were to broil it and it'd be done in, you know, like 6 minutes, or to saute it and it'd be done in 4 minutes. So it is longer than that. But, you know, the benefits of having a nice, moist piece of salmon, you know, and a very tasty piece. The fennel, the citrus that you're using here is an orange. You say a blood or navel orange, a lemon, the peppers, etc. All of this goes in a baking dish, and you are you're baking all of it, right?
Yeah, you just sort of you're just baking it in the oven like that. And of course, you could use grapefruit if you wanted to. You could use a regular orange if you can't find blood oranges. I probably wouldn't do lime here, but you know, you can mix it up.
Okay, that sounds great. We'll tell you where you can get all these recipes, by the way, on, epicurious.com is where you find it all. Asian chicken and cabbage salad. I'm seeing cabbage in a lot of these eat fresh for the new year, you know, kind of, recipes that are coming out.
Yeah. I mean, cabbage is a very unsexy ingredient, but it's one of my favorite things to eat. One thing I really love about cabbage is that it just lasts forever in your fridge. It's just such a hearty vegetable. But it's not like buying, you know, a bunch of spinach or a bunch of, you know, baby arugula where, you know, you have to eat it within 2 days or sort of wilt. So that hardiness sort of translates. It's part of the reason why it's good for you. It's, you know, it's just, it's got a lot of fiber. So cabbage is, you know, really good for digestion, and it has all sorts of other benefits. And this, you know, I personally would just kind of slice cabbage thinly and saute it, maybe even braise it with a little bacon and some balsamic vinegar, maybe put some apples in there. I'm talking about red cabbage right now. But this, you know, doing it with chicken is obviously makes it more of a full meal because a lot of people don't. I tend to eat like a rabbit sometimes, so I can just eat a bowl of cabbage, but I know some people like, more people want chicken.
Right. You would be a cult of one with that, David.
Right.
I mean, it depends
on...
Well,
maybe one of the four people listening right now also.
Right. Right. For the other three people in the world who also would do that, you can. But, so you're taking this cabbage and slicing it basically like coleslaw, pretty much, right?
Yeah.
And right. And then the chicken, 3 cups of chicken shredded, and then so are you just sauteing all this up together?
Yeah, and you know what's great about this recipe is that it's, you know, that's really good for you to, you know, just for dinner, but this is also a really great recipe to take for lunch the next day. This is gonna this is gonna last in the fridge for a few days. So I think that part of the detoxing, you know, we're talking about detoxing. And we're talking about, you know, recipes that are good for you. But the other part of detoxing, I think, especially post-holidays, is just cooking more and bringing your lunch to work and not relying on, like, for example, where I work, there's a cafeteria. And no disrespect to the cafeteria at work, but they're, you know, they're flipping burgers and they're, like, making, you know, like, chicken nuggets and, you know,
right,
quesadillas and stuff like that. It's not necessarily detoxing food, right? So as long as you're cooking... and you're bringing the stuff into work, and maybe you're even bringing your own breakfast too, you're going to eat healthier just automatically. It doesn't even really matter what you cook. Anything you cook is going to be healthier and give you some detox effect.
More than processed. Yeah, I mean, even I had this conversation with my mom the other day about, you know, a turkey sandwich, you know, the processed turkey lunch meat that you buy. You know, and I explained that that's loaded with sodium, all of those things. Even if it says turkey, which is a buzzword,
you know, that you think healthy if it says turkey somehow is loaded with sodium. You know, why don't you just make yourself a nice turkey breast, a fresh one, and slice it? And it's 100 times more healthy for you.
And what's interesting about that, Dean, is that, you know, sounds like you're a cook, so, you know, I'm obviously a big cook, and sometimes, you know, really practiced home cooks, they know that you need to use salt. You know, you can't skimp on the salt when you're, like, seasoning your food. Salt is what makes everything taste better. So I'll have people over to my kitchen, and they'll say, Dean, why are you putting so much salt? You know, end up saying, this salt's bad for you, salt's bad for you. When we talk about salt being bad for you and you know, watching out about sodium, it's not about how much table salt you put on your food if you're cooking at home. It's about things that you just mentioned, like turkey, these things that are preserved and meant to last for months and months on a grocery shelf. That's where you have to watch out for the salt.
Yeah.
I think it's very unlikely. Of course, I'm not a doctor, but I think it's very unlikely that you will salt, if you're cooking at home and you're salting your food, that you would use so much salt that it would become unhealthy.
No, it's the hidden salt, and often hidden in sweet things that you'd never expect it. You got to read the labels when it comes to stuff like that.
Yeah.
So there's more to this Asian chicken and cabbage salad than just chicken and cabbage. There's ginger and sauces and all kinds of things. The recipe is at epicurious.com. So I just want to go over a couple before we run out of time. Like this citrus salad with tarragon syrup. This tarragon syrup caught my eye. What an interesting idea for a nice topping for some fresh fruit.
I love tarragon and I love that flavor. It's a very divisive flavor, though. Are you into like that black?
Totally into tarragon. I think it's great.
Yeah. This goes back to the citrus thing. Like citrus has all those vitamins and, you know, really delicious acids. And the other thing about the great thing about citrus right now, and this time when we're trying to eat more detox-ish foods, is that we want fresh foods and we want things that are in season. You know, a lot of the times, a lot of the produce right now is not in season. It's being shipped in from warmer places, and it's not going to be as beneficial in terms of nutrition because it's being grown in hothouses and stuff. But citrus obviously is in season if you're getting, you know, and so that's automatically going to be better for you than, you know, eating something that's not in season. So season, right, you know, citrus right now is a big thing.
Yeah, so a variety of, you know, different citruses with an interesting dressing like this. The tarragon syrup sounds great. And talking about hidden sodiums and things like that, you've got a recipe here of winter lettuces with pomegranate seeds. But what I found most interesting was a homemade shallot vinaigrette dressing that you make, because bottled salad dressings are loaded with sodiums again. And you could cleanse yourself so much by eliminating, you know, some of these hidden sodiums and very easily making your own shallot vinaigrette. What's the process of that with this dressing?
Well, any vinaigrette is a combination of some sort of oil and then some sort of acid. If you're going to make a shallot vinaigrette, then you're going to start, that's sort of just like a flavoring of the vinaigrette. So you're just going to chop up your shallot pretty finely. What I would do is I would put it in a glass jar, because this is how I like to make my salad dressings. It's really very easy this way. So take a, you know, clean glass jar that has a lid, chop up some shallot, put it in the bottom of that. Then I add my acid, and I'll typically use some citrus like lemon juice or any type of vinegar, like a, you know, an apple cider vinegar or just a white wine vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
I pour that vinegar over the shallot, and I do that first because that's going to tame the shallot a little bit. The vinegar is just going to very, very slightly cook, if you will, the shallot and sort of take away
soften
the sharpest bite. Yeah, soften a little bit.
Okay.
So, and then the typical ratio, I think what a lot of people use is like a 3-to-1 ratio of oil to vinegar, oil to acid. So, you know, if you put in, it depends on how much salad dressing you're making, but if you're putting, let's say, 2 tablespoons of vinegar, then you're going to put in 6 tablespoons of oil.
Okay.
I don't think that that's always going to be the case, because sometimes, you know, it depends on the acid you're using, and you just have to taste it and be sure. But once you kind of get a mix, you can just put the screw the lid on the jar and just shake it, and that's how you get the dressing to emulsify.
You're putting a little little salt and pepper in there, maybe a little garlic, something like that also?
Yes. Garlic, you could put any herbs in there, you could put any dry spices in there. I like to put a sweetener in there usually, so I'll put like a touch of honey in there.
Okay.
Or maybe, you know, but that's, and to your point, like when you're making salad dressing as opposed to buying it, you're controlling not just the flavor, but you're controlling like everything you put into it. You're controlling the amount of salt, you're controlling whether or not there's sweetener in there. So you really, you know, the more control you have, the more ownership you're taking over your health. So
yeah, very,
it's super easy to make salad dressing.
You've made detox very appealing here today, David. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Dean. I appreciate it, too.
It's David Tamarkin, who's one of the editors at one of my favorite sites. I get recipes from you like 4 times a day, I think. It's one of the ones that
you're keeping us alive. I appreciate that.
Oh, I love it. Some of the recipe suggestions that you guys send out throughout the day are great. Epicurious.com. David, Happy New Year, and I hope we can talk to you soon. Thank you so much.